changes. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding,
you're listening to episode 557 of Unwelcome Guests, The Makings of Police State, USA. I'm Robin Upton. In a second hour, we're going to be looking at last year's FBI raids against activists, looking at some of the tactics they used to try and get people to rat on one another, and grand jury proceedings, a legal form that has been abandoned in every other country of the world, but which still lives on in the USA. Now, to make the point that this is not a new phenomenon, in our first hour, we're going to be hearing about justice 1950s style as applied to Ethel and Julius Rosenberg, a couple of communist activists who were executed for conspiring to commit espionage during a time of war. The authorities claimed that there was sufficient evidence that they had passed nuclear secrets to the Russians. Now, we shall hear evidence casting doubt on that, but even Wikipedia admits that it was a fairly controversial case. And the New York Times wrote on the 50th anniversary, quote, "The Rosenberg's case still haunts American history, reminding us of the injustice that can be done when a nation gets caught up in hysteria," unquote. Now, I wish there were more people in the USA and more editorials asking what is just. Seems to me there's a lot of people running scared, concerned only with themselves. It doesn't seem to me that that's accidental. Now let's hear, this is last week's meeting of the National Committee to Reopen the Rosenberg Case.
I'm Jolie Pataki. I'm the Vice President of the Board of Directors. And on behalf of the Board, I'd like to welcome you. President David Allman. Moni Itzkowitz is the Treasurer. Tibby Brooks is the Executive Director. Toby Emmer, Jeff Kiseloff, Robert Miropol, and Miriam Moskowitz are other members of the Board who are very happy to welcome you as well. First off, I'd like to start the program by reading you a letter from our esteemed President David Allman. If you were to ask yourself why you've come to this memorial meeting, among the answers might be that you have some uncertainty about the issues in the six-decades-long Rosenberg-Sobel case. You may have come for enlightenment about the tragedy that unfolded when several idealistic individuals obtained and passed on to the Soviet Union classified military information during World War II. You may still be disturbed by the draconian death sentences. You may have come to show the sons of the Rosenbergs that they don't stand alone in their long search for the truth, for the huddled masses yearning to be free. Over the years, our presidents and congresses and Supreme Court justices have, by new laws, presidential orders, and an authoritarian-minded Supreme Court, created the makings of a police state. The Constitution is now expressly banned from courts in which indictments for disloyalty or suspicion of terrorism are prosecuted. Prosecutors no longer have to prove defendants in such cases guilty. Defendants have to prove themselves innocent. How did we get this far from the imperfect democracy of the 1950s? If you're looking for a starting point for the 60-year assault on the Constitution, the Rosenberg-Sobel case is a good place to begin. On the surface, the prosecution and judge follow the required sequence of steps: the arrests of the defendants, their indictment and trial, the verdicts, sentences, and executions. The indictment charged the defendants with having conspired to spy for a wartime ally, the Soviet Union, during World War II, a charge for which there was circumstantial evidence for the guilt of Julius Rosenberg and Morton Sobel, but none at all the involvement of Ethel Rosenberg. But in the courtroom, the prosecution and the judge charged the defendants with treason on behalf of an enemy. This illegal switch required the prosecution to set a new high for the use of perjured testimony, forgery, invented events, illegal sentencing, and wrongful executions. Now fast forward. Today, in loyalty and national security cases, it is not necessary to arrest suspects at all. They may just be picked up for detention. The laws place no limits on the length of detention. A man or woman picked up today in a so-called loyalty and national security case may still be detained without trial on July 4th, 50 years from now. Moreover, that man or woman's family may never learn what happened to their father, mother, sister, or friend. Today, a man or woman defendant in a loyalty terrorism case may, by law, be denied the right to read his or her complete indictment. There are even cases in which judges may not be trusted with this information. How do you defend yourself against charges never described to you? How do you cross-examine government witnesses whose identity may not be revealed to you and the precise testimony against you never made known to you? How do the families of these men and women know whether the disappeared loved ones are alive or dead, sick or in good health, tortured or being treated humanely, if you can call secret detentions humane? For a really comprehensive picture of the state of justice in our country today, go to the internet, go to the websites of the Center for Constitutional Rights, the ACLU, and the websites of other civil rights organizations. Our committee to reopen the Rosenberg case believes it is possible to challenge the steps being taken to transform the United States into a police state. One big step would be to compel the Department of Justice to correct the historical record in the Rosenberg case. Official acknowledgement of the perjuries, forgery, sentencing illegalities, and the wrongful executions of the Rosenbergs would constitute a step toward restoring the Constitution to the courtroom. It could signal the beginning of the end to the serial human tragedies perpetrated in the name of national security by the Department of Justice. We will need the support of a great number of people to succeed. We take heart from a recent breakthrough we made in bringing the truth to new sections of the public. In February 2011, Z-Man magazine, an ultra-Orthodox Jewish periodical, wrote a 59-page article highly critical of the government's misconduct in the trial. When the Z-Man reporters had concluded their research, they, and an Orthodox rabbi, and an Orthodox cantor, and other participants went to the Rosenberg grave sites where they recited the 23rd Psalm, which Julius Rosenberg had recited on the way to his execution. Said Kaddish, the Jewish prayer for the dead, after which the cantor sang Kail Ma'ilei Rachamim, the prayer for Jewish martyrs. We will shortly have a condensed version of the Z-Man article on our website. It is not enough to grieve, to mourn, to regret where history has taken us. History is in our hands, if we take it into our hands. Read our informational materials and pass them on. Read the materials on our website and recommend others do so too. Help us get the word out. Help us bring the message to religious, professional, and social groups. Help us when we begin amassing petitions. Help us with funds. Help us with ideas, suggestions, as well as with criticisms. If you want to be part of the resistance to turning America into a police state, a good place to start is by asking for redress for the government's unlawful conduct in the Rosenberg-Sobel trial and for the wrongful executions of the young Rosenberg couple. Thank you. David Allman. And now we will have the eulogy I was unable to give by Robbie Mirapol, the younger son of the Rosenbergs.
I've not spoken at a memorial meeting for my parents, sponsored by the NCRRC, in several decades. That's right, several decades. There are a number of reasons for this, but one thing that kept me away was that I felt, perhaps unfairly, that past memorial meetings portrayed my parents as innocent victims, And over time, I came to view their situation as more complicated than that. But more about this later. First, I want to acknowledge another aspect of why I've joined you this evening. The NCRRC has been transformed in the last couple of years. No longer content to commemorate my parents' case, it has revived its original mission. That charge is contained in its name. It is, after all, the National Committee to Reopen the Rosenberg Case. But what does the word reopen mean today? I hope by the end of this talk to give you a sense of how today's NCRRC will apply that word. Now, I have another more personal goal on the eve of this 58th anniversary of my parents' execution. This talk is, in part, the eulogy I was too young to give when they were killed. I didn't know my parents well, but bits of information contained in the recently released grand jury minutes, Walter and Miriam Schneer's new book, Final Verdict, and Morton Sobel's startling revelations have provided me with a few additional glimpses of their lives. I'd be less than honest if I did not admit that the latest news that Morton Sobel, my father, and two others provided aeronautical information to the Soviet Union in 1948 gives me pause. My parents wrote in their last letter to me and my brother, quote, "Always remember that we were innocent and could not wrong our conscience." Now I have to ask myself, innocent of what? Right-wing Cold Warriors trumpet Sobel's recent statement as proof that my parents were liars. But it is much more complicated than that. Neither Julius nor Ethel was guilty of the crime for which they faced the executioner. Ethel was not a spy, and Julius was ignorant of the atomic bomb project. They were innocent of stealing the secret of the atomic bomb, and they were fighting for their lives. It would have been extremely difficult at the height of the McCarthy period for them to explain to their children and supporters the distinction between not being guilty of stealing atomic secrets and blanket innocence. Given that, I can understand the course of action they took from a political standpoint. But what are my personal feelings about this today? How could my parents engage in such high-risk activities that could potentially lead to their imprisonment? I was just over a year old, and my brother was five, in 1948, when my father and Mort copied the secret documents. When I wrote An Execution in the Family in 2002, I thought my father might only have engaged in helping the Soviet Union fight fascism during World War II, and I asked, quote, "How many tens of thousands of American men with young children willingly went to fight during World War II, knowing that they might not survive the conflict? Was my father, whose poor eyesight disqualified him from military service, taking a greater risk by choosing this role in the battle? Now, I know that he continued to aid the Soviet Union after the end of the war. Now, I disagree with my parents' uncritical support for the USSR and the strategy my father employed to aid it after World War II. It is one thing to work to defeat Hitler or to engage in local struggles where you can see what is happening and have first-hand knowledge of the people and forces involved. But I've learned from painful experience that it is extremely difficult to judge the trustworthiness of foreign governments, not to mention our own. And knowing the terrible toll parents' activism can take on the family, I believe parents should always take their children into account when they engage in perilous activity. I wish to be clear, however. I don't think anyone engaged in what my father did during the 1940s would seriously consider that they might receive the death penalty. In any case, I do not believe it axiomatic that all parents of young children should refrain from risky activity. The Rosenberg Fund for Children, which I founded and direct, helps parents who engage the world and sometimes take dangerous actions even though they have children. Our best chance of building a more humane and just society rests on the activism of ordinary citizens with family concerns, and such activism can't always be risk-free. I question my parents' actions more than I used to, but I've had the luxury of living a much longer life than they did, and hopefully I've learned from many experiences that were foreclosed to them. I may question my parents' judgment, but I don't reject them, and I remain proud of them, even if my father did what he could to aid the Soviet Union throughout the 1940s, and my mother supported him. Despite the awful consequences of their choices, my parents acted with integrity, courage, and in furtherance of righteous ideals, and passed their passion for social justice on to me and my brother. But how can I question my father's innocence, yet say he acted with integrity when he categorically denied his guilt? Reconciling this seeming contradiction provides the answer to this question and a starting point for understanding the rationale for the NCRRC's plan to reopen my parents' case. To understand my parents' actions, you must know something about them as people. My mother was born in 1917, my father in 1919. So they were teenagers during the depths of the Depression when Roosevelt took office in March of 1933. They were desperately poor. A friend describes how she and my mother stuffed newspaper in their shoes to block the holes in them to keep their feet from freezing as they walked to high school in the snow. My mother had a terrific singing voice. I find it ironic that she was given a special assignment of singing the national anthem at all high school assemblies. My father studied the Talmud after school, and some felt him suited to become a rabbi. Despite incredible odds, they graduated at the top of their high school's classes. My father was one of the first members of his family to enter college. Both my parents saw the world crumbling around them. They saw the meager possessions of impoverished families in their neighborhood thrown into the streets because they couldn't pay the rent. They saw the Communist Party organize squads of volunteers to break into the now empty apartments and move the families back in. They demonstrated for jobs, saw the police attack the peaceful demonstrators, and then read newspaper accounts in the capitalist press that the communists had rioted and the police restored order. They saw firsthand how the Communist Party sided with the poor and the capitalist press lied. My mother attempted to organize a union and was fired for leading a strike at her first full-time job after graduating high school. She filed a claim before the newly organized NLRB and won. My parents became young adults as Nazis rose to power, as Germany helped the fascists win in Spain, while the Roosevelt administration stood idly by. The only piece of tangible evidence seized from my parents' house introduced as evidence of a crime at my parents' trial was a tin can labeled, quote, "Save a Spanish Republican Child." They were raising money for the orphans of the Spanish Civil War. My mother took on low-paid secretarial work and sang at union rallies in the evenings. They met, married, and joined a community of young communist activists ready to engage the world as World War II started. With the passion of youth, not unlike what my wife Ellie and I felt in our SDS collective 25 years later, they carried the fight to the fascists in the most effective way they knew how, by helping the Soviet Union. My father received an engineering degree from the City College of New York. Many of his friends and political comrades had more advanced scientific training and were working in factories on cutting-edge military technology. With the Soviets bearing the brunt of the Nazi attack, sharing this information was a chance to strike a blow against the Hitler beast, as my father described him. My mother did not actively participate, but they were political partners. They and their community of young friends shared a burning desire to make the world a better place for themselves and for their children. First, they had to defeat fascism, and then they would work towards a socialist future. They weren't engaging in a political fad or merely following the crowd. This was the essence of who they were. They were not innocent victims. They were knowing political actors taking risks to further their beliefs. When repression crashed down upon them, they decided to resist rather than capitulate. They were 100% truthful when they said they acted as they did because they could not wrong our conscience. They resisted, not only for themselves, but also for their community and for their children. The government presented them with the same choice so many faced during the McCarthy period. Name names or suffer the consequences. If my parents had taken the course of David and Ruth Gringlass and ratted out their friends, in the short run, it might have been easier for me and my brother. However, in the long run, today, I am so grateful that I am the child of Ethel and Julius Rosenberg with all of the consequences. With all of the consequences of that heritage, instead of being the child of David and Ruth Gringlass, I embrace my parents' legacy of commitment and resistance, even if I might not always agree with their decisions. They acted with integrity, even if they did not tell the whole truth. But what is the impact of this new information on reopening my parents' case? Some say it is absurd to reopen the Rosenberg case when recent revelations indicate we already have all the answers. That my parents' co-defendant Morton Sobel's admissions tell us all that we need to know. My parents were convicted of conspiracy to commit espionage, these people argue. And Julius not only conspired, he actually did commit espionage. Case closed. Others refute Sobel's new statements by attacking his veracity. They contend Sobel, at 93 years old, is spewing wild fantasies, or they maintain that since he denied any involvement for 60 years, admitting he lied renders any claim he makes now untrustworthy. Sometimes these people make these seemingly irreconcilable points simultaneously. I think what Sobel said is neither a fantasy nor a lie. Sobel's revelations, however, are irrelevant to the ongoing need to reopen the Rosenberg case. This is the key point. Whether or not Morton Sobel and Julius Rosenberg engaged in espionage, the government of the United States perverted our judicial process to execute two people for something they did not do. We reopened the Rosenberg case to understand fully what the government did, and because the implications of those actions are critical to us all today. The defendant's conduct sheds little light on this. We must focus on the government's conduct instead. That's what the NCRRC intends to do. And we're not only doing this just for the sake of history. My parents' case also teaches us essential lessons about today and about tomorrow. My parents, as you heard before, were charged under the Espionage Act of 1917. The 1917 Act has an infamous history. It originally served to squelch opposition to World War I. It criminalized criticism of the war effort and sent hundreds of dissenters to jail for voicing their opinions. It transformed dissent into treason. Many who attacked the law noted that the framers of the Constitution had specifically limited what constituted treason by writing it into the Constitution. Quote, treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. The framers felt this narrow definition was necessary to prevent treason from becoming what some called, quote, the weapon of a political faction. It appears obvious that the Espionage Act is unconstitutional because it does exactly what the Constitution prohibits. It is, in other words, an effort to make an end run around the treason clause of the Constitution. Not surprisingly, however, as we've seen in times of political stress, shortly after its passage, the Supreme Court upheld the Espionage Act's validity in a 5-4 decision. It's no accident that Bradley Manning and Julian Assange may be charged under the same act in 2011. And it is also no accident that Manning and Assange may face a conspiracy charge, just as my parents did. All that is required of the prosecution to prove a conspiracy is to present evidence that two or more people got together and took one act in furtherance of an illegal plan. It could be a phone call or a conversation. In my parents' case, the only evidence presented against my mother was David and Ruth Greenglass's testimony that she was present at a critical espionage meeting and typed up David's handwritten description of a sketch. Although this testimony has since been shown to be false, even if it were true, it would mean that the government of the United States executed someone for typing. But the reach of conspiracy is even more insidious. It means that anyone with whom my parents discussed their actions and politics could have been swept up and had similar charges brought against them, if someone testified that those conversations included plans to commit espionage. Thus, the case against my parents was rightly seen by many in their political community of rank-and-file Communist Party members as a threat to them all. Viewing the WikiLeaks situation through this lens, it becomes apparent why the government would seek to charge Manning and Assange with conspiracy. Not only those two, but anyone involved in the WikiLeaks community could be swept up in the dragnet. Just as in my parents' case, the prosecutors could seek to bully some involved into ratting out others in return for more favorable treatment. This divide and conquer approach would turn individuals against each other, sow the seeds of distrust within the broader community, and intimidate others into quiescence. This kind of attack threatens every activist. Although later Supreme Court decisions seem to criticize and limit its scope, the Espionage Act of 1917 has never been declared unconstitutional. To this day, with a few notable exceptions that include my parents' case, it has been a sword of Damocles, awaiting the right political moment and an authoritarian Supreme Court to spring to life and slash at dissenters. And this is just one of the many ways in which lessons taught by my parents' case could impact modern-day cases. Another concerns capital punishment. While the Espionage Act of 1917 may be used to punish Bradley Manning for spreading the truth, in my parents' case, it was imposed to employ the death penalty. April 5th of this year marked the 60th anniversary of Judge Kaufman's pronouncement of the death sentence against my parents. Kaufman justified the death penalty by saying their, quote, conduct in putting into the hands of the Russians the A-bomb years before our best scientists predicted Russia would perfect the bomb has already caused, in my opinion, the communist aggression in Korea with the resulting casualties exceeding 50,000. The hoopla about Morton Sobel's recent statements serves to distract attention from Judge Kaufman's towering lie that the government of the United States knew that neither Ethel nor Julius Rosenberg stole the secret of the atomic bomb. Kaufman's statement remains as false today as it was in 1951. The FBI, the Justice Department, and Kaufman were guilty of a much more serious conspiracy than any my father was involved in. My father passed secrets to the Soviets, but the government fabricated evidence, suborned perjury, manipulated the jury, wrongfully executed two young parents. The government subverted the rule of law, violated the Constitution, and damaged our democracy. 60 years later, the government still refuses to come clean, and most of the corporate-controlled media continue to ignore this scandal. This is the basis of the NCRRC's rationale for reopening my parents' case. It does not take a genius to figure out that it's possible to be guilty of one thing and not guilty of another. My father was indicted for conspiracy to commit espionage, and in a fair judicial system, he could have been convicted and sentenced to prison for that act. At the trial, however, the prosecution, with assistance from Judge Kaufman, transformed the formal indictment into an oral charge of stealing the secret of the atomic bomb at a time when New Yorkers feared an imminent atomic attack. The fact remains that my father was innocent of that crime, and that is the crime the prosecution convinced the jury to convict him of. Interviews with several members of the jury years later confirmed this. My father knew almost nothing about the atomic bomb project and was not directly involved in stealing any atomic secrets. It is a little known fact, but the words atomic bomb never appeared in my parents' indictment. You could say that the government pulled off a legal bait and switch in their case. New evidence provided in Walter Schneer's posthumously published book, Final Verdict, verifies this conclusion. Walter discovered from reviewing research generated by the files of both the U.S. and the USSR that during the 1940s, whenever an American Soviet agent had information relating to the atomic bomb, it was transmitted within a few days to the Soviet Union. However, the sketch the Gringlasses testified about at my parents' trial, that they swore they had given to my father in September 1945, did not arrive in Moscow until late December of that year. What could cause a 3-month delay? I originally believed that David never drew such a sketch until the government coerced him into doing it shortly before the trial. But Walter Schneer discovered that the sketch described in the Soviet archives contained the same errors and matched the sketch David testified he drew in his cell just a few days before the trial. That's powerful proof that Gringlass really did draw the sketch in 1945, later found in the Soviet archives. But that's not the end of the story. So Gringlass really did draw that sketch, but it didn't arrive in Moscow until almost 3 months after the supposed September 1945 meeting. Walter Schneer's explanation of this discrepancy shocked me. In January of 1945, the FBI discovered that Julius Rosenberg, who had been working for the Army Signal Corps of Engineers, was a member of the Communist Party. In early February, he was fired from his government job. A KGB file dated February 23, 1945, stated, quote, "The latest events with Julius Rosenberg, his having been fired, are highly serious." The memo concluded that the FBI had probably discovered Julius's work for the USSR. In response, the Soviets immediately terminated Julius's career as an active agent and had all his contacts turned over to others. In other words, the KGB suspended my father from active duty in February of 1945. The supposed September 45 meeting, 7 months later, at which the Gringlasses say they gave my parents what the prosecution called the greatest secrets known to mankind, did not take place because although my father was reactivated by 1948, in September 1945, when the meeting was supposed to have occurred, he was not actively aiding the Soviet Union. Instead, the KGB files indicate that Ruth Gringlass, on her own, without my parents' involvement, met with Soviet agents on December 21st, 1945, and delivered the sketch the government called The Secret of the Atomic Bomb. That's why the Gringlass sketch, which we now know was worthless, was not delivered to the Soviet Union until December 27th of that year. Imagine how my parents felt sitting in the courtroom, listening to David and Ruth Gringlass swear they gave Julius the sketch the government called The Secret of the Atomic Bomb, and that Ethel was present and typed up David's handwritten notes that accompanied the sketch, knowing that they'd not been involved in any of this. The testimony about typing was virtually the only evidence against my mother. Picture how she must have felt as the prosecutor argued for her conviction, saying that she, quote, struck the keys blow by blow against her own country, when she never saw any notes and never did any typing relating to the atomic bomb. Knowing that they were sentenced to death for something they did not do is ample justification for claiming that they were innocent. And it is ample reason to reopen the Rosenberg case. So, how do we intend to do it? Regardless of my father's actions in the 1940s, neither Ethel nor Julius Rosenberg received either a fair trial or a just sentence. Today, we work to fulfill the NCRRC's mandate, that is, reopening the Rosenberg case, by seeking a federal proclamation to redress the wrong that was done my parents. The object of this campaign would be to obtain the federal equivalent of the proclamation issued by Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis in August of 1977, the 50th anniversary of Sacco and Vanzetti's execution. That proclamation did not rely on Sacco and Vanzetti's innocence, but concluded instead that because justice was not served in their case, that any stigma and disgrace should be forever removed from the names of Nicola Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti, from the names of their families and descendants. This proclamation might be timed to coincide with the 60th anniversary of my parents' execution, which would be June 19th, 2013. We already have lawyers doing the research needed to provide the legal underpinnings for such a campaign, and we need your help to spread the word of this effort and provide financial support for it. For the first time since the 1980s, since the end of our Freedom of Information Act legal action against the government, the NCRRC has a plan to reopen the Rosenberg case. We've embarked upon this course not merely to right a wrong done at the height of the McCarthy period. We seek more than cleansing from our nation the stain of the wrongful execution of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. Just as Julius and Ethel and the generation of the 1930s struggled to build a better world for their children by defeating fascism, those in the generation of the 1960s and my children's generation engage in this anti-authoritarian effort today because it is a key component of the ongoing struggle for legal, constitutional, and human rights for all our children and all the generations that follow. Thank you.
Now, Robert Mirapol's brother, Michael Mirapol, was not in attendance, but he sent the following statement to be read out.
I want to take this opportunity to give great thanks and appreciation as a non-board member to members of the board, not just my brother, though he deserves great credit as well, who have stepped forward in the past 2 years and made the decision to, in someone's immortal words, seize the time. They have set themselves a daunting task to turn the NCRRC to a new purpose, which was the original purpose, to seek redress for a crime committed against our family and against our country by the U.S. government back in the 1950s. This is not an easy task, and I commend each and every one of them for it, and thank you who are here tonight for your continuing support. Thank you, Michael Mirapol. And now we will have short presentation by Jeannie Mirror. Jeannie Mirror is president of the International Association of Democratic Lawyers, a founding board member of the International Commission for Labor Rights, and she is also co-chair of the National Lawyers Guild's International Committee. She has been a member of the National Lawyers Guild for 42 years. She practices law, labor law, and employment and civil rights law in New York City, in a firm of Eisner, and that last one was cut off. Myrer. Not your Myrer. Okay. Jeannie Myrer. I was asked to speak about the relevance of the Rosenberg case to the current spate of post-9/11 terrorist cases. As Robert Meerpol, I was 6 years old when Ethel and Julius Rosenberg were executed. Although I do not remember the trial or the demonstrations protesting their executions, my recollections of that period include hearing my mother cursing at the McCarthy, at Joe McCarthy every time he was on television, but then telling me not to repeat what she said to anyone. As a child, I was not aware that I was living through the McCarthy era, but I recall vividly the fear-mongering about secret communist cells, which were supposedly everywhere in the labor movement, even in the army, and that there were many dupes. My parents were New Deal liberals who abhorred what was going on, but the trial and execution of the Rosenbergs enhanced the fear of being labeled communist or fellow traveler and chilled their right to speak freely. Coming of age in the 1960s and the renewed hopes that the civil rights movements, the anti-war movements, the women's movements, I decided to become a lawyer to try to use legal skills in the interests of people. I was naturally drawn to the National Lawyers Guild. In 1969, I attended my first National Lawyers Guild conference in Columbia Law School, and it was called The Role of the Radical Lawyer. In this meeting, I first met Arthur Kanoy. And Arthur spoke about the work that he, Mike Curlin, Frank Donner, and others did in June of 1953 in the last-ditch attempt to stay the Rosenbergs' execution after Emanuel Bloch reported that the stay that Justice William O. Douglas had issued against the execution was likely to be vacated by the full court. I want to read the speech he gave to us in 1969, which eventually became part of his book, Rights on Trial, because it is instructive for our time. That is, what he told us is important not only to understand the times, but also to underscore the need for people today to push back against the climate of fear that the war on terror has instilled in many. This is Arthur's story. Mike Perlin, I can't do a good Kurt Kanoy, but people remember. You know, Mike Perlin, Frank Donner, and I were working late on a Thursday evening in June in the small rooms of our converted New York apartment that served as our office when the telephone rang. The call was to have an effect on us from which, in a sense, we never recovered. When I picked up the phone, Emanuel Bloch, the chief counsel for Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, was on the other line from Washington. I have never heard anyone quite so distraught and upset as Manny Bloch sounded. He stuttered and blurted out, "They may vacate Douglas's stay. The execution may go forward ahead tomorrow night." He talked on and on about what happened. As he talked on, what happened became clear. All the Rosenbergs' formal appeals had been previously exhausted, and their executions had been set when 2 days before the scheduled executions, Justice William O. Douglas, in an act of judicial heroism, granted a stay until the new
till the court could granted them a stay of execution until the new issues raised by their lawyers could be briefed and argued in the lower courts. All of us had breathed a sigh of relief when Justice Douglas signed the stay, because a week before that, the Supreme Court had adjourned for vacation and would not be back for business until this term opened in September. All was safe through the summer. Since the trial almost 2 years before, huge movements of support had developed for the Rosenbergs, demanding a halt to their executions. People had demonstrated in major cities throughout the world, insisting that the barbarism of the executions be stopped. Even the Pope had pleaded for the Rosenbergs' lives. The relief just granted by Justice Douglas seemed to be the answer to the world's demands. Now this new development that Manny Block was explaining to me threatened their lives again. The Chief Justice Fred Vinson had convened an emergency session of the entire court, calling them back from their vacations to consider overruling the stay of execution granted by Justice Douglas. Stunned, I could think of no other time that such a thing had happened in the history of the court. Manny went on, in words I shall never forget. The court sits again at noon tomorrow. Looks like they're definitely going to vacate Douglas's stay. Execution tomorrow. Do something. Figure something out. Get back to the Court of Appeals. Do something. We stayed up all night talking, pulling out books, poring over appeals papers that were in our office. By 3 a.m, we came up with an approach, a way to do something. We even got excited about it. It was the last resort plan of action. When the full court vacated Justice Douglas' stay the next morning, we would ask for another federal stay of execution by developing a variation on the approach that had captured Douglas's attention the week before. The act under which the Rosenbergs had been sentenced permitted the death penalty only in a time of war. But there was no declared war at the time of their alleged acts of espionage. Applying the death penalty at a time when the country was not actually at war thus might be challenged as unconstitutional without statutory authority. By 5 a.m, we had jammed out a set of federal habeas corpus papers which put forth the theory that the courts had no power under the statute to sentence the Rosenbergs to death. Then we started working on a plan of action to obtain a last-minute stay of execution that same day, pending full consideration of the new habeas corpus papers. The only way we could do this was by going back to the trial judge in the case, Irving Kaufman, and starting all over again. There was no hope of getting Kaufman to grant any relief, particularly if the Supreme Court did not vacate Douglas's stay, for Kaufman's own reputation as a judge depended on the full vindication of the propriety of the death penalty he himself had mandated. But all we needed from Kaufman that morning was one word, denied, on the petition for stay of execution, so that we could present the emergency appeal to the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. So now it was up to us. The fear and trepidation, Gruber, Perlin, and I walked down the corridor of the office of the Chief Judge of the Circuit, highly respected and conservative Judge Swan. To our surprise, we won a first important battle, getting past the bailiff in the outer office, and then the secretary by insisting we had a critically important paper to present to the chief judge. While we waited for the judge, Perlin put a call into Washington. The news, as expected, was that at noon the full Supreme Court had vacated Douglas's stay, and the execution was now set for 8 that evening. What seemed like an hour of sitting in the reception room, looking at our watches every minute, and the knowledge that 8 o'clock was the outer limit, we were shown into Judge Swan's office. We quickly told him why we were there, and to our astonishment, he did not throw us out, as we expected. He looked at us and said, "All right, tell me what your theory is. Why should I grant a stay of these executions?" Then, with a faint smile, he added, "You've got a mighty heavy burden to carry. After all, the Supreme Court had vacated Douglas's stay." So Perlin, Gruber, and I sat there and laid out our theory, developing every point as we talked. Judge Swan picked up our papers. He mentioned several cases on which we were relying. We had mentioned several cases on which we were relying. He called in his clerk and asked for the volumes we had mentioned. He opened them up and leafed through them, and then it happened. He looked at us and said, "You've got a point there. It makes some sense. I'll tell you what I'll do. I can't grant the stay by myself after the High Court has vacated Douglas' stay, but what I can do is convene a panel of this court this afternoon, two judges of the court and myself, to hear your application, and I'll vote for the stay. I'll convene the panel if you can get one other member of the court to agree to sit on a panel and consider granting the stay. That was beyond our wildest expectations. We blurted out, Judge Swan, what other members of the court are around? Who can we get to see? Who is in New Haven? He thought for a moment, and then he said, Judge Frank. Judge Frank is here at his home. We sat stunned for a moment. He was sending us to Jerome Frank, the leading liberal judge on the court. Jerome Frank, the intellectual leader of the New Deal and architect of its most progressive legislation. Jerome Frank, the idol of young progressive law students and the leader of liberals when he taught at Yale, who had led the fight against conservatism and the old guard faculty by championing long before its actual victory, later the cause of clinical education in law school. We were going to see Jerome Frank. We stood up half dazed at this turn of events, scooped up our papers, and one of us turned to Judge Swan and asked, what's the judge's address? What's Judge Frank's address? The judge looked at us at his watch. It was about 2. He said, you don't have very much time. Then he picked up the telephone, called for the car assigned to him as chief judge to be brought around, and gave instructions that we'd be taken immediately to Frank's home. Things were moving in a way we'd never dreamed of. For the first time since Manny Block's phone call, the possibility of stopping the Rosenberg executions became real. Judge Frank was at his door to meet us. Swan had evidently alerted him that we were coming. He welcomed us in a friendly way, escorted us to his living room, and as we sat down in comfortable, easy chairs and nervously opened our briefcase to take out our paper, he smiled at us and looked for ways to put us at ease. The first thing he told us was that Judge Swan had called to say that an open telephone line had been established between the clerk's office in New Haven and Sing Sing and the New York State prison where the Rosenbergs were being held, because the federal authorities were borrowing its electric chair for that evening. We looked hastily at our watches. It was 2:30 in the afternoon. As Judge Frank saw us glance at time, he said, all right, present your case. We argued as we had never argued in our lives. We put forward all the arguments. Then when we tried to cut short any point worrying about time, Judge Frank would interrupt and say, no, develop that point, lay it all out. Afterwards, he would say, fine, develop the next point. And we did. At last, we finished. We had been talking and arguing for more than an hour. We looked up at him, and he looked at us and was quiet for a moment. Then he said something I shall never forget. He said to us in soft, slow words, if I were as young as you are, I would be sitting where you are now and saying and arguing what you are arguing. You are right to do so. But when you are old as I am, you will understand why, and he paused and he repeated, why I cannot do what you ask. I cannot do it. We sat there stunned. This was Jerome Frank, the liberal. Jerome Frank, the progressive. We left without saying saying more than a formal goodbye to Judge Frank. Time was pressing furiously upon us, and we had only a few hours left to find another judge of the circuit. Everything in Judge Frank's words and tone made it abundantly clear that he could not be moved from his position. He said nothing to us and would not look at us as we left. His back was turned. He just stood in the door motionless. Jerome Frank might, in a profound sense, have changed the course of American history that afternoon. He could not do it. He was a prisoner of the system he served. As a liberal, as a progressive, he had risen to a position of leadership in society. He would jeopardize the usefulness of those labels and accordingly the position they afforded him if he participated in the act of courage that Judge Swan, the conservative, was prepared to take. The labels, Frank's liberal past, imprisoned him,
kept him from the course he would have taken if he were as young as we were, and we were as old as he was. He was telling us we would understand that to preserve our position in society, we must compromise with those in control. That was Arthur's story. It was abundantly clear to all of us who knew Arthur Kanoy and who were lucky enough, as I was, to be mentored by him, that he never did compromise with those in control, and that is a lesson we must bring forward today. In the Rosenberg case, the Espionage Act of 1917, which was upheld as constitutional by the Supreme Court in 1919 in Schenck versus United States, was used to execute Julius and Ethel. But since the end of the McCarthy era and the beginning of the civil rights, anti-war, women's, and others' movements, there have been many government efforts to disrupt progressive movements and to use repressive measures like COINTELPRO to target civil rights and anti-war activists. Grand jury abuse then and now is legion. One of the areas where NLG lawyers excel is in fighting grand jury abuse. The National Lawyers Guild has often successfully thwarted grand jury indictments by advising those who are called to testify to refuse to cooperate. But the mere fact of being investigated is inherently chilling of people's actions and willingness to protest. 40 years ago, when Daniel Ellsberg leaked the Pentagon Papers, he was tried for a violation of the Espionage Act of 1917. His trial ended in a mistrial when it came to light that the White House plumbers had broken into his psychiatrist's office in an attempt to find negative information about him. Our dear friend, the late Glenn Wineglass, represented Daniel Ellsberg. Ellsberg spoke on television the other night in conjunction with the 40th anniversary of the publication of the Pentagon Papers and their declassification. And he noted that with the Patriot Act, now many of the illegal actions against him which were revealed and led to his mistrial are now legal. We need to address this terrible expansion of the national security state, which is the legacy of 9/11 and the perpetual war on terror. In 2001, the Cuban Five were tried and convicted of conspiracy to commit espionage. And one of the five, Gerardo Hernandez, conspiracies commit murder in connection with the shootdown of the brothers to the rescue plane, which had been crossing Cuban airspace and dropping leaflets in Cuba, for which he was given 2 life sentences. Even though there was no evidence that any of them ever saw, let alone obtained classified information or knew of the shootdown, when the total reason for their presence in the U.S. was to gather evidence on the activities of extreme right-wing Cuban groups in Miami who were plotting terrorist acts against the island. Fighting for the release of the Cuban Five is difficult, as there has been almost a complete news blackout on the case, and every time the five are mentioned, they are referred to as Cuban spies. We are finding out more and more about the efforts of the government to prevent a change of venue and to pay for negative press stories about the case to prejudice the jury. And there is currently a new habeas petition pending. But today we are facing not only the use of the Espionage Act of 1917 being resurrected for WikiLeaks, about which I will mention more later, anti-war and other progressive movements are being threatened by allegations that they are materially supporting terrorism. Indeed, NLG sister Lynn Stewart was tried and convicted on the charges of obstructing justice and conspiracy to provide material support for terrorism, when she violated the special administrative measures in place for the visitation of Sheikh Abdulrahman, who was convicted of plotting to blow up various targets in New York and whose case she was appealing. Whether you agree or not with Lynn's actions, the threat of being charged with material support of terrorism at this time is very real. That is, last year, the Supreme Court in Holder versus Humanitarian Law Project found the law regarding support for designated foreign terrorist organizations to be constitutional.